It was actually a larger list of 20 names, which also appeared with this, that had all indigenous funders. And they were not really placed in an order, they were placed entirely mixed up. You had the Archduchess here, you had a Canberra Catholic there, you had an Empress here. So obviously it's a mutual sort of funding of this institution. The biggest name that was placed in above the Empress in grand big letters, even in a marble slab in St. Aloysius, was the name of Florence Le Beau Prepu, a Canberra Catholic munsif and a large landowner in Central Mangalore. It was he, an indigenous Canberra Catholic, who contributed between 7.5 and 9 acres of land on Edia Hill, upon which the central and grandest Jesuit institution on the soil of South Canberra, St. Aloysius College, was built. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much for a fascinating paper. I'd like to push you a little bit, and perhaps this is an unfair question, but I'm trying to link up what you said today with what we heard last week, which is that there was a kind of, at least, a form of Protestant nationalism which emerged very early in Bengal and was extended by people like the Rudras in the later 19th century, became part of this C.F. Andrews type of Christian activity, which ultimately linked with Gandhi himself. And this wasn't simply indigenism or culturalism, it was actually a form of nationalism, and it was quite critical of the British Raj, really right from the beginning. Now, I'm not sure that that was nowhere near a dominant feature of Protestant Christianity, but from what you're saying, the Catholics, and particularly Jesuit influenced Catholics in the South, didn't have that degree of anti-colonialism, not even that degree of anti-colonialism. They were fundamentally culturalists and indigenists, and they remained British, loyal British subjects more or less to the end. Is that fair, or?
Well, actually, so this is my first chapter of my PhD. The second and third chapters focus on Canberra Catholic participation in nationalist politics.
Okay, good.
And what I deal with there is there was among educated Canberra Catholics who were now competing with British, there was a rising sense of national consciousness already described. It was starting to manifest itself, but very, very few. You would generally have that among the migrants who went to Bombay, Calcutta, and Madras. It is there that they would be politicised and the local movements there. The movements did not come very much to South Canberra because the Catholics in South Canberra are still positioning themselves as loyalists. Mm. But Canberra Catholics outside were adopting nationalist, such a broad term, but you get what I mean, national sort of inclinations. And through magazines and letters they were sending back home, the social remittances, Peggy Levitt argues, migrants don't give up ties with home, migrants keep ties with home and other migrants. And through these ties, a sort of a national consciousness been forged in South Canberra through the information coming back in. Also, because the Canberra Catholics spread across the British Empire as migrants by 1920s, their nationalism didn't just sort of unfold within a particular group in India, a particular nationalist sect in India. It was actually, you had a Canberra Catholic in a Canberra Catholic lecturer, marching around America, speaking about nationalism in India. And he joins the Qadar movement in California. You have another Canberra Catholic who joins the communists. You have two other Canberra Catholics who do something else. In fact, the Nationalist Christian Party, which was set up in 1930, was also founded by a Canberra Catholic. What separates their version of nationalism, most of them, not all, from the broader narrative, is the fact that what they generally called for was dominion status within the British Empire. They were very, very concerned that the loss of dominion status in the empire would mean jeopardising the Christian position in the subcontinent.
Okay, thank you very much. So I'm throwing it open to questions, please. Yes.
just to sort of actually draw you out a little bit more on the political context of these things, I was very unclear about your discussion about the mystical end of the changes that make sort of Catholicism very mystical in the middle of the 19th century, which allow for people to have direct access to God, which undercuts, yeah, as it were, the hierarchy of church. Now, I mean, you would know this better if you're interested in history of Christianity. But these theological movements, yeah, are very much related to changes in politics. So,
yes,
mentor,
yes,
but
yes.
Also democracy, mm-hmm. what people are talking
yeah.
about in political theology in terms of this is what leads to kind of new forms of sovereignty, right?
Yeah.
So even if they're not, you know, I grant them that, you know, this is a very, very, very loyalist project.
Yeah.
It's neither here nor there, whether they're nationalist
yes.
or not. That's
yeah.
for you to, you know, think through. But nevertheless, I mean, it changes conceptions of popular politics in the 19th century. So whether it's revolutionary Europe
yeah.
or whether it is actually highly tumultuous India at this time, Kanara seems like a kind of oasis where nothing seems to happen in your account apart from these, you know, people. So I just want you to actually, you know, link up some of these things
yeah.
with broader political movements
nice,
and
yeah.
your theology itself. Is not immune
from
it.
No.
So I'd like you
yeah.
to actually think a little bit
yeah. Thank you very much for that. I mean, on the point of mystical porte, I should just specify, mystical did not mean, the church very clearly defined, did not mean mystical in the sense that we understand it. I mean, it's not, not the direct access, but what it meant was, because when the Pauline notion was revived, the porte of Christ, the church felt, and the reason it was rejected, the word body of Christ was rejected in the First Vatican Council in 1870, was because the Pope said then, Leo XIII, the one before him, said that the notion of body of Christ and that members are part of the body of Christ was very biological. It wasn't very nice. So then the next council of sort of the 1930s, during the time of the encyclical, 1943, Mystici Corporis Christi, they specify and say, no, we mean mystical, to differentiate it from the natural body of Christ. So all the word only the only purpose it served was sort of incorporation. But the rest of your points, I mean, of course, I very much do take, and I do realise I need to build on the political movements to a great extent. Thank you.
Your description of the Catholic hierarchy
yeah.
and the diocese in South Canberra seemed to be rather sort of seemed to present it as rather a sort of closed system, and I just wonder whether there were what contacts or conflicts perhaps there were with other Christian groups. I mean, I think particularly the Syrian Catholic Church or the Nestorian groups on the Malabar Coast, even with perhaps Anglo-Catholic high African groups who may also be operating in that area. Were there contacts?
There were. I actually, in my 45-page version of the chapter, this was a 10-page version, I actually do talk about Protestants and the Syrian Christians as well. Now, as I mentioned, there were German Basel missionaries, German Protestant Basel missionaries in South Canberra. But they were also a minority, and they were a low-caste minority. Now, what I talk about in the chapter is there was a very interesting thing that happens between them. The Protestants and the Catholics settled down to mutual cooperation, where the Catholics focus on Brahmins, and the Protestants focus on, when the Catholics focus on the established church.
Is that all Catholics?
No, sorry, in South Canberra.
The Jesuits.
No, in South Canberra,
yeah,
the Catholic Church.
The Jesuits who are focusing on higher caste groups, or all Catholic missionaries?
No, in South Canberra, because you did not have a separation of secular clergy and religious clergy, and it was a mission that was entrusted to the Jesuit religious clergy, the Jesuits, the policy of the Catholic Church in South Canberra was Jesuit. And it was, we will appeal largely to these high caste groups. However, since, as I mentioned in one place, the increasing number of Christians in the area, which largely on account of Protestant missions with the lower caste Balawas and Mokaviras, the Torti Tapping and Fishing communities. That is when the Catholic Church realised, it rediscovered in a sense its missiological purpose. It realised that we aren't able to convert many Brahmins in recent years. The Protestants have just gone from nothing to having 20,000. We will come back. We will now appeal to the low caste missionaries. And then I made a statement very briefly about how by 1939, as a result of, from 1890 to 1939, as a result of Catholic work among the lower castes, you had 11,239 people from the Karaka caste adopting Catholicism in a single year. Now, another thing you might be interested about is that there was a particular Jesuit called Francesco Corti, who, I cannot do it in this PhD, I have 3 years, but for a future project, his policies are very influenced by Roberto di Nobili, the famous Jesuit who sort of adopted Catholicism in an Indian context. That might be an interesting thing to link up as well. With Syrian Catholics, the quote I made about Europe and America being evil was actually made by a Syrian Catholic living in Mangalore. He was part of the adopted Kanra Catholic fold. He was a teacher at St. Aloysius College and very respected. But to, again, leaders like him, the ones who are more easier to be influenced into the nationalist sort of, with national sentiment, were not the Kanra Catholics themselves, but these have been in, who have been coming in from the Syrian, from Kerala and from the others, who don't feel as much of an ethnic allegiance to Europe. See, for many elite Kanra Catholic families, we're still deep inside. We don't speak about it, but we think we are Portuguese to some degree, whereas the Syrian Christians didn't have that. So it does change a little bit.
You've made a case for these transnational connections,
yeah,
influencing a hybridisation of identity, and the claims of the Kanra Catholics upon the Catholic Church, you know, Pilgrims to Rome and so forth.
Mm.
I wondered whether there was any evidence in the archives of the effect that this relatively small group,
yeah,
of Catholics had upon the wider Catholic Church.
Is there
a sense that they're being noted? Are they simply just this exotic, to use your word, group that are sort of at some distance? Or do the impact, and, you know, particularly in the 1950s, as the Catholic Church is beginning to think about preparing for Vatican II, where there's quite a shift in the way it understands itself globally, whether there's any evidence of that at all?
It's a very interesting question. I must say I haven't looked into it very much. Have I come across anything in my research? Obviously, the Catholic Hierarchy of India, which was made through a bill called, an encyclical called Humanae Salutis Actor, was very much a papal encyclical driven by Indian concerns. But that of course, is Indians affecting the Vatican for India. To what degree can the Catholics affect the global Catholic movement? I don't think they did very much, which is why they felt we just have an ornamental value. We want an even, equal place in the global church, and it's by the 1930s they're fighting for that. What is our gift? Like the three, you say we're three kings, we are three kings. What are those gifts that the three kings can bring to the vicar of Christ? Is it our wisdom and philosophy from the East? And what exactly? And these then influence sort of enculturation movements. And being hypothetical here, this is not, I've not done, I've not, it's not backed with sources.
Yeah, I mean, it seems to me that one thing that distinguishes this is the extent to which the Catholics include a lot of very wealthy local elites, and still do. I mean, I was at St. Anne's Sound, which is just after that computer laboratory opened, which was funded by their contacts at IT Bangalore, in the IT Bangalore industry, and they're loaded with money. I mean, very, very wealthy indeed. Why were the local elites drawn to Catholicism? Is it they managed to succeed in getting this purchase, which in some ways distinguishes them?
It does, doesn't it? Well, two things. One, of course, they were converted in the 15th century, in the 16th century, under Francis Xavier and his missionaries in Goa. Well, now, why did they move to South Canada? Therein lies the root of the answer. They migrated to South Canada because of the Goan Inquisition. There were three. It's a very disputed issue. I'm not going to go into the debate. It's Goan Inquisitions, Maratha invasions, those two was an if and all, but the third, which is unanimously agreed, is at the behest of local Ikeri Rajas, of the local Rajas of the Bednore dynasty, who wanted skilled cultivators to settle on their lands. And he had heard of the Brahmins in Goa, the Brahmin landowners in Goa being very skilled, and when he knew they were leaving, he invited them to settle on the lands. It's not just migration of Catholics down south. It's God's blessed Brahmins, who were already a very mercantile, a very sort of powerful class in the Bombay presidency. The Catholics are all from the majority are from the God's blessed Brahmin class. You have the God's blessed Brahmin Catholics and the God's blessed Brahmin Hindus. Well, coming down, Hindu is a bad term, but forgive me here. They're all coming down to South Canada, where they're granted lands, and they come to form a landed gentry. Then they go into the timber industry and the shipbuilding industry. They're maritime. The Brahmins in the area, had rules about maritime trade. They don't go on the sea. The only people, the traditional traders were the Moplas, the Muslims, who were half Arab, half, you know, not half, a mix of Arab and Indian. They controlled the transoceanic trade there. For the Cano Catholics, they were landowners who would supply things to the Moplas, who would then take it to Africa. And so they built ships, they and owned plantations. Under the British, coffee was introduced, tiles were introduced, and that was the source of their wealth, and later on government service.
So in a way, I mean, the success of the mission is because it fits with local caste structures and customs and so on. It moves into those structures.
Yeah.
Rather than challenging.
No, exactly, exactly. Mm-hmm. Oh yeah, but the Jesuits in Goa, it was entirely, I mean, they did everything they could to preserve the status of the Brahmins as Brahmins through all of their interlogical Orientalist projects. And yes, sir.
Please.
I wonder if you've made any comparison any time with what happened in the Philippines. Because, I mean, what you said about the lack of indigenous priests also applied to the Philippines. But they got so cross about it, some of them. The early nationalist movement of the early 20th century led, of course, to a split. So an independent Catholic church was established. I think it would be a very interesting thing to compare the thoughts and ideas of the very few Filipino Catholic priests who are also nationalists with those who were in Catholic.
Fascinating. I haven't done anything on it, but it's fascinating.
Split, there was a split in the Roman Catholic Church in the Philippines as a result.
Please.
I was just wondering on that point, because the lay people were obviously so proactive and willing to make their views known to when it came to the lack of people being priests, was that, in the evidence you found, was that because they just didn't want to go that way, there wasn't a sense of vocation, or were they trying to become priests but were being turned down by the foreigners?
They were being turned down. They were refused. It was institutionally sorted. They could not. They could, if they went to Goa and studied, there were economic factors that came in. If a family could fund to send their son to Goa, where he was studying the seminary, and continue identifying as Goanese, but the Goanese, the Goans in Goa, continued to have the privilege. All the priests were not actually really Portuguese, they were Goan Portuguese, many of them. So there was still that sort of, if they identified as Goan, if they went back to Goa, studied in the seminary, learned Latin, Greek, or whatever the other subjects, and they could afford to do that all at their own expense and come back to South Canara, perhaps they might have been. But that was not the case. There was a mixing of economic and sort of institutional systems of discrimination. It's again a very modern term. But,
yes, please.
Okay.
Yeah.
My helpless curiosity about the Vatican. The Vatican. I loved reading about black popes and white popes and conspiracies and as a child. Nothing figures in my work now as a child. But that, you know, what you read as a child has consequences on you as an adult. And, yeah. Sorry, it's not very noble. But so.
Well, I've got one final question. Quite a lot of these South Indian Christian communities preserved facets of previous culture.
Yeah.
For instance, various forms of festival and so on, and the days of the festival and so on. Is there anything like that, or have these people been so thoroughly acculturated so early that there's very little of the kind of Hindu context?
But that's a very, very important part of my research. It's actually, they're not entirely Western.
Hmm.
They're hybrid. and they're fighting for, and even what's Western, they don't see as Western, they see as Christian. Our Christian civilization, what Christian civilization has produced in the context of the culture of Western culture, it is producing in the context of Eastern culture. There are bound to be similarities. Of course there are, it's not that ideal, you know, easy, but there are. There are festivals, one example. It's called the Montu Mary Fest. It's the feast of the Blessed Virgin Mary on the 8th of September. And I don't know when the Catholic Church, I think the Catholic Church officially celebrates it on the 8th of September. I'm not quite sure. But it has been internalized by the Canberra Catholics. The Canberra Catholics had a feast marking the harvest, something to do with the agricultural calendar. And the date of the festival has been moved to merge with the date of the agricultural calendar. So while the entire district is celebrating the bringing in of new grain, the Canberra Catholics in their homes are also thanking God and the Blessed Virgin Mary for the protection of the fields through which these new grains are coming in. So there are that sort of mixing, but does that answer your question?
Yes, I think so.
Hindu ritual, temple ritual, Mediterranean Catholic ritual, overlapping, incredible way of procession, carrying the gold of the Virgin Mary, I mean, in Vasco de Gama thought that Kerala Hindus were Catholics.
Yes, of course. No, that's very interesting. It's all very interesting.
Well, thank you very much for a very interesting talk, and thank you everybody for participating.
Yes, thank you.
So you're in the final year?
Yes.
Yeah. And you're writing furiously.
Yes, there were too many sources and too little time.